Hello, my name is Dr. Rachel Marsden. Welcome to this podcast, created as part of the Royal College of GPs and Health Education England's Clinical Priority Programme for Sepsis. I am the Clinical Support Fellow for this programme, as well as a Portfolio First 5 GP living and working in Sheffield. Sepsis remains highly topical and is still a major cause of mortality and morbidity across the UK. Although the burden of sepsis cases is carried by the very young and elderly, the condition can strike at any age, regardless of the health status of the individual. Even if treatment for sepsis is successful, patients often face a long recovery process and many onward challenges. I'm lucky enough to be joined today in the studio by Dr. Alison Taveray, a portfolio GP from the South West whose work on sepsis recently earned herself and her colleagues the BMJ Patient Safety Award and the HSJ Award for work on the management of the deteriorating patient. Alison, welcome, and many thanks for finding time in an exceptionally busy schedule to join me here today.
Thank you, and thanks for asking me.
Alison, that was a very brief introduction. Can I start the interview by asking you to tell us some more about yourself and your work?
So I'm a frontline GP in Bristol, and alongside this, for many years, I worked in professional sport, partly in football, but I was also the medical officer at Gloucestershire County Cricket Club. However, more recently, I've developed an interest in sepsis, and I also work as a clinical lead with the West of England AHSN, the Academic Health Science Network.
What is the AHSN? Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
The Academic Health Science Network is a collaboration between the NHS, both acute trusts and primary care, and also the universities. And the aim of this is to support the adoption and spread of evidence-based medicine. One of the main themes of the AHSN, particularly in the West of England, is improving the identification and management of the sick patient, which is how I became involved due to my work on sepsis.
Okay, and how did you develop this interest in sepsis?
For me, it started after I developed sepsis myself following spinal surgery. It was all very traumatic and I told very few people what had happened. However, about 18 months after the operation, I was asked to become involved in a quality improvement project at the hospital where I'd been a patient. And to my surprise, I agreed. Speaking as a clinician and a patient provided an insight which others have appreciated. And I was later asked to represent GPs on the NICE Guideline Development Group for Sepsis. As a frontline GP, this wasn't a career path I'd planned, but it's proved to be really positive.
Well, professionally, Alison, we could learn a great deal about you from sepsis and its management due to your work that you've done with the AHSN. However, you also have a more personal perspective, as you mentioned earlier. Are you able to tell me a little bit more about what happened to you when you had sepsis?
Yes, certainly. I had surgery to stabilise my spine and it appeared to work really well and I regained the power in my legs. But a few weeks later, I started to feel vaguely unwell. I was readmitted and my CRP was 580.
Okay, that's impressive.
Yeah, it was pretty high. So I stayed in hospital for 2 weeks and started to feel better. And as my CRP was almost normal, I came home, which was great, with a PICC line in place, but I seemed absolutely fine. Mm. However, 24 hours later, I suddenly woke up with this incredible feeling of doom and the absolute certainty that I was about to die. I remember asking my husband just to call an ambulance, and that was the last time I was able to speak properly for some hours. And within a few minutes, I started to have rigors. I remember we've got a king-size bed, the whole bed was shaking.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and then at the same time, the paramedics rushed into the house and took me straight to hospital with blue lights.
Okay.
But unfortunately, when I arrived, the junior doctor mistook my anxiety for a panic attack. And that was really scary because I knew I was very sick. I felt like my heart was going to explode. But I can understand why she mistook my anxiety for panic. I remember looking at the arrest trolley at the end of the bed and thinking, well, at least they won't have to go very far for when my heart stops. But a few hours later, something started to change. And I remember looking at my husband and over his right shoulder, there was a grey tunnel and I was starting to disappear down it. And I told him I wasn't going to make it through. And you can hear from my voice, it's a very vivid memory. Luckily, at that moment, the doctor came back onto the ward and apparently I'd started to look different, so she put some fluids up. Later, I was taken to theatre and after about 3.5 hours, they managed to get rid of all the pus. interestingly, a pre-op ECG showed severe ischemia.
Okay.
It's quite challenging to have a look at that, but it means I was right to feel that I'd been about to arrest.
So obviously that's very difficult. Thank you for sharing that with us. Mm. And that's only just a short part of the journey. Mm. How are you now? How have you been since then?
Before I had sepsis, although I worked as a GP, I actually knew very little about the long-term consequences of sepsis and its long-term impact. But obviously, since it's become very personal, my opinion and knowledge has changed. And the most obvious problem for me is the effect on my spine. Mm. And I've since had to have another 5 major operations on my spine. And it's very likely that I'm going to have more because it's so damaged. I developed severe spinal stenosis, and although I've had a multi-level decompression, I've got long-term nerve damage in my legs and have to use a stick at times as I get neural claudication. And as you found today, it's little things like, because I've got no lumbar support, whenever I enter a room, the first thing I do is scan and look for a chair with lumbar support, and they're not always as available as you might expect.
No.
But the other thing that surprised me is the flashbacks. Even when I told you earlier, I can remember what happened, but I didn't get too emotional because I knew that I was going to talk to you about it. And I was mentally prepared. But what surprises me is, at other times, quite unexpectedly, the flashbacks can be triggered and I just want to cry. And in fact, when we got the BMJ Awards, which was an absolutely amazing evening, we came off the stage. It was a huge audience. We had photographs taken of the whole team. Mm. And then everybody else went back to the table to celebrate. And I sat in a corner, phoned my husband and cried, because you can't. I don't think I'll ever forget what happened to me on that night. But you know, fortunately, it's been something I've been able to take on and move on positively.
Yeah, you say that. Obviously, having sepsis has been a significant part of your life and has had its negative impacts. But I have to ask, have there been any positives that's come out of your journey?
To my surprise, there have been absolutely loads of positives. One of the most unexpected is I've become a lycra-clad cyclist. I have trouble walking, as I mentioned, I'd have to use a walking stick. But when I cycle, because I'm leaning forward, it opens up my spine and therefore I get the power back in my legs. So I've set up a cycling group with my friends. We call them my rehab group. There are about 25 of us and we're out 2 or 3 times a week cycling the lanes of Bristol. And so far this year, I've covered about 1,800 miles with another cycle ride to Clevedon planned for tomorrow.
Excellent.
So the other surprise is the impact on my professional life. I can't bend and twist. So I've had to reduce my clinical commitments. But being a member of the NICE Guidelines Development Group has opened up lots of doors for me. And it feels really good to be able to play a part in improving outcomes for patients by raising awareness of sepsis. But I also hope that the work I'm doing with the AHSN helps to raise awareness of sepsis amongst my colleagues and support them in their identification and early management of the sick patient, because none of us comes to work wanting to miss somebody who's really sick.
No. What advice would you give to doctors who are faced with a patient in whom they are suspecting sepsis, because it's suspected sepsis that we're looking for? And I note here that you are in a very unique position of being able to give us insight from both the patient and a professional basis.
I think the first thing is to think, could this be sepsis if a patient presents with an infection? Very much as we exclude a cardiac cause if a patient complains of chest pain. And I think it's this increased awareness, which is what we need, is so important for clinicians, because patients with sepsis have such vague presentations.
Mm, absolutely.
Because of the multi-organ failure presentation of sepsis, with brain failure, with respiratory failure, the effect on the renal system, effect on the cardiac system, symptoms are so vague. And there's often this feeling of doom, which I personally experience, which increases the anxiety. So I think the history is very important, and especially risk factors such as immunosuppressant medication, chemotherapy or recent surgery. But alongside this, a full examination is very important using a structured set of observations such as NEWS or the National Early Warning Score, which has been widely recommended, as you know, by NCPOD, by NICE and by the Ombudsman. And I learned about NEWS through my work with NICE, and at first I wasn't sure how relevant it would be for me as a GP. But I remember I was asked to see a very anxious patient who just turned up in the surgery one lunchtime. She didn't look particularly unwell, and she just had a vague story of a cough. But I started to examine her. Her respiratory rate was up. So I went ahead and did a full NEWS score, and she had a score of 5. And to my surprise, I admitted her with a diagnosis of sepsis secondary to pneumonia. And without NEWS, I don't know that I would have realised just how sick she was. And that's one of the reasons that I want to share what I've learned, because it's worked for me and it works for many other GP colleagues, to support them in those times when they don't quite know what they're looking at.
It was that combination of clinical judgment and physiology that worked together to make you make that decision on that day.
Absolutely. And then also that feeling that, have I missed something, which I think most GPs have, particularly at the end of the day when we're tired. You're worried that you might have missed something. And having a raised score confirmed I had. But if she'd had a score of 0 or 1, then I'd have felt confident that she wasn't severely ill.
It's our gut instinct, isn't it? GPs have that gut instinct that there's not something's not quite right here.
Absolutely.
Okay. Do you think GPs should NEWS or a National Early Warning Score every time we see a patient, or, you know, is it just now and then?
No, I definitely don't think you need to do a full examination every time. You know, if they've got ankle pain, knee pain, it's not going to be relevant. But if there's an infection, I've got much slicker and can get a full set of obs very quickly. So I put the oxygen probe on as I'm doing the electronic BP, and I'm measuring the respiratory rate, and I enter it onto a digital template. So I can get the score very quickly, which helps inform my decision making. And even if the patient's not that sick, I also like the way it provides evidence of a complete examination, which gives me some medical-legal support. That's a surprising benefit for me, particularly when it's patient 35 at the end of a very long day.
We've all had days like that.
Yeah, I know my clinical acumen is not what it was at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Definite brain fatigue setting in by then.
Undoubtedly brain fatigue.
Oh, any other GPs using NEWS in your area, or is it just the enthusiasts?
Initially, like anything, it was the enthusiasts and the early adopters of any change. But what's happened is in Bristol and the west of England, we've started to ask for NEWS scores when the patients are admitted.
Okay.
So it's quite routine for the acute GP team, the single point of access, to ask for the score and its component parts when we call to arrange an admission. And they use that to help decide where patients should be seen. So if they've got a NEWS score of 3, then they could be seen in ambulatory care. A NEWS score of 5, seen in the ED. A NEWS score of 7, they're seen in the ED. And blue light transfer recommended.
Okay.
It's not absolute, because patients, as we know, could have a NEWS score of 0 with acute coronary syndrome.
Yeah, absolutely.
Somebody might have a NEWS score of 9 and be at the end of life, and an admission would be inappropriate. But we found that immensely helpful as GPs. It's much easier to get patients admitted.
Oh, so it's a tool for you.
It's a tool for us, and for the admitting team, it helps them with their risk assessment. And alongside that, we have to give a NEWS score when we're arranging an ambulance transfer.
Okay, so it is definitely.
So they're using it for risk assessment as well. So we've got some really good clinical evidence of this working, because it's a system-wide change.
That preempts my next question. I was going to ask you if there is any evidence for the use of NEWS out of hospital. Obviously, it's very well established in hospitals and got a growing base of evidence in ambulance trusts. But we as GPs don't tend to use it. So what is the evidence?
The evidence is building. When we introduced the work at the AHSN, our premise was that by using news when we made a decision to admit, we were starting the tracking and triggering element of news one step earlier, i.e. by tracking the news score, if it got worse, then we would trigger an action such as a senior review or the observations being done more frequently. So we felt, although there was no evidence for its explicit use out of hospitals, we were extending the in-hospital use one step earlier. But with time, we're accumulating much more evidence. And so I said earlier, we thought clinically it was a good way of working, but the National Patient Safety Measurement Unit, which is part of NHS Improvement, have used the HES data, the hospital episode statistics data, to look at mortality from suspicion of sepsis. And whereas in England as a whole, apparently the mortality remains subject to what's called common variation. I'm not a statistician, so I'm just quoting what I've been told. In the west of England, there's a measured reduction from mortality, which is statistically significant. And we now have the lowest mortality for the whole of England.
That's very impressive and very encouraging.
It's phenomenally encouraging. And we all felt our belief was vindicated when we saw the results. So our role now is very much encouraging adoption and spread, because obviously the mortality is reducing for our patients. We're hoping to be able to look at the data in more detail, because there's something called the Suspicion of Sepsis Dashboard, which is being launched in September. And we can question it further, but it appears that the length of stay might be slightly less as well.
Thank you again, Alison. I appreciate that you shared your experience of some difficult times today. So thank you for your bravery. If people do want to learn more other than contacting you, is there any other opportunities for that?
Yes, there are lots of opportunities. I've been asked to speak all over the country.
Thank you for listening.